Mr. Farley goes to Europe. Fuel cells make their way to Ward's 10 Best and how to prevent hack attacks.
Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone. Your journey, our passion.
This is Auto Line After Hours with John McElroy, episode 266 for November 14th. Magna's CTO talks tomorrow's tech for today's cars. Watch Autoline After Hours live at autoline.tv every Thursday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time or 2300 GMT. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for Autoline in iTunes, Stitcher, or by following the links on our website.
Well, Gary Vasilash.
John, how are you?
Let's do a show tonight.
Why don't we do that first day of winter, I think.
Oh, man, it's freezing cold out there.
Yeah, we were talking earlier about sliding on the streets, and I think we're going to be starting here soon.
Well, you know, what makes it so killer is just a couple of days ago, it was nice and warm. So, you know, to get blasted with the winter vortex, boy, it's tough to make that transition.
Indeed, indeed.
So we got to let everybody know we've got Drew Winter in the house. Drew, of course, is the editor-in-chief of Ward's Auto World, and great having you here, Drew.
Thanks. It's great to be here, John.
But our special guest tonight, is Swami Kotagiri, the chief technology officer of Magna, the giant Canadian supplier. And, Swami, it's so good to have you here as part of Autoline After Hours.
Good evening, John, and thank you for having me. Look forward to the discussion.
Well, let's get into the discussion.
So for people who don't know Magna, I mean, I think it's astonishing. I think that maybe John, Drew, and I remember once upon a time when Magna came out with a car. But, I mean, it just astonishes me when I look at what the company does, all of the things it does. So could you explain to the audience, you know, what you guys do, what you're involved in, and so they get a baseline of what Magna's all about?
Sure. I think Magna, as you said, is a tier one company based out of Canada. It's number three globally in the automotive tier one list. We are number one in North America, and most importantly, we have a very broad product portfolio, all the way from metal forming, which is the body and chassis systems. We have seating, we have interior and exteriors, we have drivetrain, we have DAS systems based on cameras. And we also have contract manufacturing, which is actually making full vehicles all the way from design to production.
What's DAS?
Driver assistance systems.
Okay, so for like lane keeping, that sort of thing?
Yeah, that's one of the many features that we talk about. I think a good example would be the bird's eye view, the 360 view, as we call it, on the Mercedes S-Class. And many other vehicles coming in the future.
That's good.
Yeah. Well, I think that a lot of people don't know how many vehicles you've made. I'm trying to think. The X3 you've manufactured, Jeep Grand Cherokees.
That's right.
Well, what we should mention is, and you explain it, the Steyr operation.
Yeah, I mean it's a operation that you own and you build under. Under contract, right?
Assembly plant in Austria.
It's an assembly plant in Austria. Like I think you mentioned some of the previous platforms that we did, which is the BMW we work. Currently, we manufacture the Mini, Countryman, and Paceman.
That's right,
We do the PSA, RCZ, and we do the Mercedes G-Wagon. We have been manufacturing it for the last 34 years, or 37 years, I think, and we continue to do it from our Austrian facility.
So I was looking at a list of things that you guys do here.
Yeah.
Okay. So you make the lift gates for the Rogue and for the BMW i3. You've developed active front deflectors for pickups. You have a self-foam load floor for vehicles lightweight, expanded polypropylene door panels, aluminum vacuum die-cast structural components. You do hot stamping, thermal set carbon fiber components. You have vision systems. You do mirrors. Pumps, hybrid modules, hydrogen storage systems, hybrid batteries. I mean, you guys do like everything for virtually every single auto manufacturer out there.
Yeah, I think Gary, you stole my thunder.
I'll shut up now.
No. I think those were some of the key highlights. I think you bring up a good point. One of the key things for us is we are a global company. We have over 312 manufacturing locations. represented in 29 different countries, over 130,000 people, to be able to do what you just said. What you mentioned, some of the things, kind of paints the picture for Magna. The broad spectrum of products that we do, which means we have the experience in product, process, and material to be able to do what we just talked about. And we kind of sum up all of these things and say we want to make the products smarter, cleaner, safer, and lighter. Keeping in mind at all points of time, as we address each of these topics, the market has to be able to sustain it, so which we call it make the innovations affordable.
Right? So do you guys develop technologies that you then present to your OEM prospects and say, we've developed this, or do the OEMs come to you and say, Magna, you guys have such a wide array of capabilities, we want you to develop X for us?
It goes both ways, Gary, right? Our innovation process, we start by looking at the socioeconomic macro trends. For example, you know, fossil fuels. We talk about individualization. We talk about the digital lifestyle, the changing demographics, the tastes of the people. We take all of that and say, if all of these things are true, what is the impact in the automotive industry in general? Then we take it to the next step and say, okay, what does it mean to Magna and the products that we make today? We see what we do today and recognize the issues, challenges, and the product trend going forward, and that drives some of the solutions that we can take to a customer. That's from one side. The other side is the customers coming to us because every customer has a specific issue, depending upon what the brand stands for. Whether it's performance, whether it's lightweighting, whether it's addressing CO2 emissions. When they come to us, we go back to them with a solution that we might already have in a generic platform, but we tailor-make it to address what they have, you know, as an issue.
So what are you working on now that you can tell us about that you're thinking, I'll bet these car companies will like this when we show it to them? What sort of areas as a CTO are you trying to invest in?
Like I said, the four areas, John, that we talk about is the smarter, cleaner, lighter, safer, right? When we talk about the lightweighting technologies, as Gary mentioned in the past, we have a broad base of experience in materials, whether it's plastics, whether it's carbon fiber, whether it's aluminum, whether it's steel, all alloys of steel. And also there are processes associated with it. So we can hot stamp, we can cold stamp, we can roll form, we can cast. You know, all types of processes that are required. With that background, we are always looking at, you know, the different systems that we have to. Now, why do we do that? You know, for example, let's take the CO2 emissions. Our lightweighting is a way to address the CO2 emissions to make the vehicles better. Then we go about by each system and say, okay, here is the application of aluminum, here is thermoplastics, here is carbon fiber, and then we take it down to the next step and say, what are the processing challenges that we have? One good example was the multi-material lightweight vehicle that we did working with the Department of Energy and the OEM partner Ford. We addressed so many issues on the right application of the material for the right parts, right joining technologies, right coatings to address corrosion issues of dissimilar materials. So that's kind of what drives innovation overall for us. So that's one broad theme that we continue to address. The second thing is efficiency improvement, whether it's, again, fuel economy or CO2. I'll take the example of drivetrain. Provide torque and power to the wheels when you need them. Our disconnect system, which we call the Optimax or the Flex 4, a few ideas that we have on drivetrain that are going into production are in production. We continue to optimize them, produce power and torque to the wheels when you need them. So reduce parasitic losses because you don't need to have the all-wheel drive and four-wheel drive running all the time. You should be able to sense it, use it when you need it, disconnect it quickly. That's another example of being smarter.
Yeah. Let's go back to lightweighting a minute. There's
yep.
so much talk about aluminum, you know, all triggered by the F-150. They're not the first by any means, but because of the volume, everyone's talking about that. Do you think we're really going to see a wholesale conversion to aluminum in the auto industry?
One of the projects that we did, the multi-material lightweight vehicle that we unveiled in June, was a good example of aluminum usage in the right application. I don't believe all aluminum usage is the only answer. As you look at it, we had in that vehicle about 66% aluminum, and the remaining was steel.
And that was a Fusion, by the way, so you were working on a Ford car for that project. So.
That's right. And the idea there was to demonstrate the right use of application of aluminum where it needs to, right? So I don't believe aluminum is the answer for everything, but the increased use of aluminum is definitely a trend. That's what I would say.
So you mentioned one of the things that you do when you're looking at material use is to say, okay, maybe it has a weight advantage, but are we going to be able to make this part in an economical way? Are we going to be able to make this part such that people will be able to afford it? So, I mean, how important is that when you're looking at technology development, the manufacturability aspect of it?
Oh, a value proposition equation is always one of the first things we look at, for sure. Like I said, the use of aluminum also brings up questions on joining technologies. How do you join it? What is the impact it would have on the manufacturing process, for example, in the body shops? What type of coatings do you use? All of these come into play, and that is what actually drives the specific R&D projects for us in any aspect. When we look at addressing an issue, the first thing I told you, we like to make the products, affordable. The market should be able to sustain it. So the value has to be higher than, what you spend on it. So that's always a question that we try to answer before we go into a project.
Do you do any consumer evaluations? I'm a veteran of many years of covering materials technology, and I remember plastic cars and how everybody had a plastic car in the works or had it out back in the late 80s or the early 90s. And there was a great deal of excitement, enthusiasm about the benefits, but that just consumers never seemed to see the benefit of, the fact that the plastic didn't rust or it didn't dent or whatever. And, when I look at the Ford F-150 now, I had questions before I drove it. I thought, how much is a consumer going to value this? Well, when I got behind the wheel, it feels really light. It handles great. I think that's going to be where the consumer can actually see the benefit. But with all these materials solutions or issues that are coming up, does the OEM strictly handle that and tell you, well, we're thinking about this, or do you give them feedback of saying, well, it's going to cost more, and I don't know what, it'll save weight, but I don't know if the consumer is going to see the benefit in this?
Yeah, like you said, I think the important part is not, the material. It's something that you consider, but at the end of the day, it's the fuel efficiency and how you feel sitting in a car when you drive it.
Yeah.
On products like seating and other things, we do get some input from clinics and things that we do with the direct consumer. But we always depend upon the OEM or our customer to give us their holistic approach. We might be providing a body in white or a seat or a lift gate, but there is a holistic approach to how the design has been done on that vehicle. For example, if you're lightweighting a car to reduce or to drop down the CG, then there is a little bit of importance to the roof and the upper body panels. If you're talking of lightweighting because you want to have the right weight balance between the front and the rear, then it has a different significance. So lightweighting, when you talk about, doesn't necessarily always mean CO2 emission reduction and fuel economy. Sometimes it also means driving dynamics and the feel and so on and so forth. So we have to work with our OEM customers to understand what is their overall strategy that they're trying to achieve. We have a lot of interaction on that aspect of it in every system that we work with.
So are you materials agnostic? Do you just say the right material for the right application?
Absolutely.
I mean, we had the MDX body in white here with the safety ring that hot stamped. It was those guys.
That was our 2014 PACE Award.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And like you said, the idea there was to be able to take the hot stamping technology, address it to light weighting. One of the key things there, it was a laser welded one piece body side, entirely done at one shot. So we worked with the material supplier and we worked with the OEM to meet their needs from their design architecture and, you know, their manufacturing process. And our expertise is in being able to make it, right? So we continue to work with all material manufacturers. The new materials in steels or aluminum comes. We focus on what application, where does it fit, how can I form it, how can I join it, so to bring it to scale and to commercialize it.
And that was a pretty dramatic, too, innovation that you put, because it allowed Honda to pass a particularly difficult crash test, right, the small offset crash test, which is very difficult to meet, and that allowed them to do it. So that's pretty dramatic. But is there anything typically now when we talk about materials, there's about four. I mean, there's new alloys of steel, there's aluminum, there's carbon fiber. Is there anything else out there that you're seeing? Magnesium might be another one. But is there anything else out there that we don't talk about that you think might be having an influence down the road as it gets tougher and tougher to make lightweight vehicles?
I think one of the biggest things in my mind is to be able to address the joining techniques. I think to be able to address the joining techniques of dissimilar materials and address the corrosion issues of dissimilar materials coming together would be one of the real achievements if you go through that, think through that. One example, like I told you, on the multi-material lightweight vehicles, one material is not the end-all solution for everything. And you need to have strength, you need to have energy absorption, you need to have reduced deflection in some cases, you need to have being able to, for example, in the front rail of a car, you need to be able to crush in a predictable way. And certain materials have, that feature. So if you can put the right material in the right place without having the limitation of if these two materials together come together, the potential difference is too high, so you have a corrosion problem. Or I don't know how to join them together because the heat affected zones are so dissimilar and there is a big difference in the stiffness and strength. I think that's not a very attractive topic to talk about, but
an important one. Yeah, you got to hold these cars together. What about structural adhesives? Wouldn't that overcome a lot of the issues you just described?
Yeah, I think structural adhesives play definitely a role in the all aluminum vehicles that we keep talking about. We still have the fasteners, and it provides a lot of peel strength when you go through that. You have to still address some of the applications in the manufacturing. How you apply that, how do you treat it to be able to get the strength that you need? Like I said, it still has it's good, but there is ways to go if you want to get to the next step.
You mentioned carbon fiber. What are your thoughts about what BMW is doing with the i3 and the i8, going with a carbon fiber structure? Although really it's sitting on an aluminum frame. They're going back to body on frame with these cars.
And I think carbon fiber definitely is a material to be considered for strength. What we always look for, I think, Gary, you brought up, is what's the value proposition and the cost equation to look at? Does it have applications in certain parts in niche vehicles? Absolutely, yes. If carbon fiber comes to a certain price point, that's one part of it that we have to address, the energy consumption, the recyclability, the fiber orientation, and so on and so forth for parts. But the second thing also as you go through is, does every part need to be carbon fiber? I mean, how far can you go in terms of lightweighting? I'll take a door panel for an example. You can get only so thin at some point, you addressed everything you need to, and after that, you start having the buckling issues, and it's not as much only gauge at that point. So there is a limitation on how thin you can go and where you can go with it. So carbon fiber, I see definitely an application in components, but in the near future, How many parts, and is it the 200,000, 300,000 units per year, or is it more the 20, 30,000 units per year is the question.
But it's interesting, you've mentioned a few times about whether you would make all of the parts out of a particular material.
Right.
And it seems to me that if we look at the history of the auto industry, we've pretty much standardized on steel or some variation of iron, right? And we've always thought that's what you make cars out of. So from the point of view of a technologist, do you see that from now going forward that we'll no longer just have this monoculture of using one material as we did with steel, and that each individual part will be looked at from the point of view of what material is best suited to produce this part with?
Yeah, I always tend to think, and we as a company tend to think, what's the functional attribute that is required at the end of the day? So you have performance requirements, whether it's durability or safety regulations or durability. And if you have that defined in key attributes, then we should start looking in your toolbox and say, what material can get us there, right, rather than go the other way. But obviously, one key thing is you have legacy constraints. You have the material supply. You have already established body shops and, manufacturing techniques that are there. So that will obviously constrain you to a solution. But I think that's where the research comes into play. If you identify those bottlenecks and say, here's how I do it today, but I wish I could do this in a lesser time, then this material or this process can take a much bigger role in the whole structure. Absolutely, yes. And I think that's the way to address it rather than go the other way around.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. We talk about materials a lot, but you guys are also involved in powertrain systems. Mm-hmm. Where do you see this playing out?
I think as you start thinking about efficiency, which means you're downsizing engines, so you're not at the same time giving up performance. So you will see, and you continue to see, a lot of evolution or revolution in boosting technologies. You see a lot of power on demand, whether it's skip firing or deactivation of cylinders and so on.
And we're going to have to hold this thought, Swami. Yes. We're going to come back to this and finish it, but we're getting close to taking a quick break right here.
Yep.
And hold that thought. We'll come back to it.
Yep.
There's only one car company in America that's never made a single car. And while you won't find Firestone cars on any showroom floor, they're out there running better, faster, stronger, longer. No, we don't build cars. But make no mistake, Firestone is a car company. So whatever you drive, drive a Firestone.
I want to really thank Firestone for being our sponsor here. And Magna came close to being a car company, too. But let's finish that thought that you were talking about, the multi-approach to this.
Yes. I think the question was on the drivetrain. And I think the key there is, how do you optimize efficiency, reduce parasitic losses? Some examples I just mentioned where the all-wheel drive, four-wheel drive systems that come into play only when needed rather than be running all the time. We have products on that. We are the largest supplier of pumps. Again, this is one of those things that people might not know. And again, pumps, when you get electrification to a point where they work and provide service only when needed. This is component level electrification, component level efficiency, and providing power only when needed.
So your water pump isn't running all the time when you
exactly
need the water pump to be running, and that's just wasting energy unless you need
that's
that.
That's right.
And
exactly.
We're already seeing that, right? I mean, there's already a number of engines out there with electric water pumps.
Mm-hmm.
And then they're talking about electric superchargers and all sorts of electrification type.
Absolutely. And electrification takes a role in many of the component systems that are not directly visible. And I think by doing that, you can add up to a lot of efficiency as we go through. So We work on all those components.
You guys even make hybrid battery systems.
Yes, we do. I think we worked on some other things. Again, right, our idea is we take the broad spectrum of what are the trends in the automotive industry, what are the new emerging areas, and how can we play a role. But one other aspect that many people don't know is even though we have a broad spectrum of the products, we are pretty much in the pole position on most of them. We are number one in metal forming. We are number one in latches. We are the number one in outside-inside mirrors. We are the largest supplier of all-wheel drive, four-wheel drive, and so on and so forth. So that is also one of the key things is to be a relevant supplier with the trends and provide value. So I think that's one of the examples.
Mm-hmm. Swami, we've got a number of questions here coming in from viewers. Let's get to some of them, see if you can answer these. Wright Knight wants to know, didn't Magna aid GM with the Fiero program, the space frame with the plastic bodies that was later used on Saturn?
Honestly, I don't know. Maybe it was
that was before your time. Yeah. Okay.
But I look up into it.
Yeah. Do you guys know it?
Ben, I remember they had this big machine that had it, they had a space.
The mill and drill.
Yeah, the mill and drill machine. I don't know who. I can't remember.
Actually, did that together. Vic Esposito wants to know, some lane keeping systems will nudge the car back into the lane. Can this be defeated in wintry conditions?
Yeah, I think the lane keep and the lane assist are two different things. One lets you know that you're getting off the lane. The other one actually nudges you back into the lane. And our vision-based DAS systems can do both. Mm-hmm. So I think the question there is, most of these vision systems or any sensory system provides input to the necessary, whether it's steering or braking, and the ability to react to that depends on systems like I talked about, which is the Actimax or the drivetrain system, which helps providing torque when needed, where needed, measuring slip, so which is another sensory function. So all of these things have to work together as we go forward.
So it sounds like he's asking, though, yeah, if you're in suddenly these oh-my-God situations that you can just... You could turn the... It's not going to be working against you when you're trying to...
That's right. The sensory device gives you the input. You react to it by steering into... But if there is a slip that is detected, hopefully the drivetrain sees it and says, okay, I need torque in this wheel in this direction and correct that again.
Oh, okay.
So it's a combination of all.
But the steering wheel torque wouldn't be such that, like, going, oh, my God, the car has taken over.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
So Rivera Notaria wants to know, if I'm reading this right, what's the most Magna car out there? What car is out there where you've developed most of the stuff that's on it?
Oh, that's a difficult question. It depends. I think we have significant content in many vehicles. For example, on the GM pickup and the truck platform, we have significant content. We have significant content on the Ford Fusion. I'm just giving a few examples. Mm. We have content in BMW, Mercedes, and most of the North American, European, or Asian OEMs, we do have content. It'll be difficult to say which one has the most content.
You know, it's interesting, you know, speaking of OEMs that are using Magna content, so this is sort of an inside baseball thing that, you know, three of us are very familiar with, but when we go on programs with car companies, they basically all make it seem like they invented everything, and it's very interesting that Kia actually calls out the use of the Magna system for their all-wheel drive system, and I've always found that to be fascinating that they would say, oh yeah, we have a guy from Magna here, and you know, you can talk to him about it, and so obviously your system is worth talking about by even third parties who use it.
But it seems like automakers are a little bit more generous now in giving suppliers credit than I remember back. They wouldn't, like you said, they wouldn't say anything. But now it seems like they are a little bit. Would you agree that they're a little bit more willing to acknowledge a supplier's contribution to some good feature?
Or? Absolutely. And I think there is a lot more interaction way ahead in the programs, too, to be able, like, you know, we discussed at the beginning of the show, here are the challenges that we are trying to address and how can we work together going forward. And MMLV was a good example. And there are many other examples on the drivetrain or, you know, some of the pumps or The PACE award that we talked about was an example of a lot of development ahead of time. And I think, yes, you're right, there is a lot of recognition of working relationship between suppliers and OEMs. And I think that needs to even increase more because it's mutually beneficial. They are addressing the problem they need to have. And the suppliers get to see the strategy ahead of time and plan to bring solutions to them.
We talked earlier about how Magna owns the Steyr plant in Austria and assembles cars for different companies. Magna came very close to buying Opel from General Motors. We got a picture here. Ben, I don't know if you can bring that up right now. Do you remember or are you aware of, because this might be before your time. Unfortunately, it's not between our times here with Gary and Drew. The Magna Torero.
I was just thinking about that.
Here we got it up there.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
This is where Magna went out and developed an entire vehicle pretty much on its own.
Yeah, I think that, you know, it has to be looked at in terms of showing and learning, you know, what the customers would expect. And if we have to go to them with a system solution addressing it, we want to show the capability. And I think our CEO has mentioned, you know, a few times now that we intend to stay as an automotive supplier.
And not compete with your customers.
Right, exactly. It's a clear message from that. So most of these things, as we work through vehicle platforms, it's more to understand the interaction of different systems and how important it is to get a holistic view of the full vehicle.
That's critically important,
isn't
it? Instead of doing discrete components.
Exactly.
Do systems engineering.
Exactly, yes.
But at the end of the day, you sell components. So.
That's right. Absolutely.
Well, Swami Kotagiri, it's been really interesting having you on here. It's amazing the breadth of technology that Magna's into. You're really impressive. And I didn't realize, third largest automotive supplier in the world. I didn't know that you
That's
guys
right.
had grown to that level. Just really impressive.
Thank you.
So, yeah, we really want to thank you for having come on the show, and it's been really great.
The pleasure is mine. Thank you very
Good.
Much.
We're going to take a short break here, and then we'll come back, and I'll talk with Drew and Gary about some of the news and other things we see going on in the industry.
Have you seen what's been happening with our other shows? Here's this week's Auto Lineup. And it starts with the surprising news that despite the continuing drop in gas prices, more and more Americans are buying more and more electric cars. And that's totally opposite of what's going on throughout the world with the sports car, according to our friends at BMW. And finally, we gave you a drive, literally, in the 2015 Mercedes-Benz Sprinter with its new 4x4 system. For more details on these stories and others, check out our website or click on our YouTube channel. And don't forget our latest episode of Autoline this week on a groundbreaking program to get more students involved in today's manufacturing. All that and more on Autoline.tv.
What an interesting company Magna is.
Yes,
unbelievable.
Broad portfolio. That's the thing that astonishes me. I mean, everything from, you know, latches to lock your door to, you know, the Lincoln MKC mirror that puts the logo
on the
light.
The pedal light.
It's just like.
Yeah, and it's funny. Well, when we talk to other people, you know, who aren't in the industry, they're always seem to be shocked to learn how much technology and how many good ideas the suppliers actually provide.
Right. Right. I know you said that you think OEMs are more receptive to talking up their supplier partners. I'm not so sure.
Well,
I
guess,
see it quite that rosy.
Well, I remember times when you try to say who supplied it, and they, you know.
They just clam up.
They clam up, or they'd pretend, well, it's, you know, that's our part, you know.
Yeah. Right.
Well, you know, and speaking of suppliers and OEMs, IHS did a study, a global study, in looking at the relationships and how they're working out with one another. And according to this new study for 2014, nearly 75% of car makers have received lower ratings than in 2013, with an average index rating reduction of 2.8%. So just almost across the board that
it's going down.
So
sure. Well, as times get better, it's my theory there's this inverse relationship. The worse the times, the more suppliers and automakers kind of they get scared, and then they are forced to work together as best they can. In good times, then suddenly volumes go up, you get these deadlines, and then, of course, suppliers start increasing prices, and then automakers start pushing back, and then you start getting this, you know, the Marchionne came out not long ago and started what? He started sort of complaining that, gosh, these suppliers are making an awful lot of money.
Right.
You know, I mean, I think that's, you know, when times get good, the relationships start to fray again.
That's right. No, and but other suppliers have told me Marchionne is the only one who's said that publicly. And they assure me others are saying the exact same thing.
Oh, you know they are, of course. Yeah.
Right. You're making too much money.
Yeah.
So interesting things going on in the business. I'm dying to ask you guys, what do you think of the swap at Ford of Jim Farley moving from really being the chief marketing officer of the company to running their European operations, and Steve O'Dell, who has been running Ford of Europe, coming to take Farley's job?
Well, Jim's a very smart man. Okay, we've got to start there. Okay, he joined Toyota. He right out of UCLA.
Got one of the best marketing guys in the business.
You know, and he knew his stuff. But what was interesting, I started looking into his background, and he actually was general manager of product management for Toyota Europe. So.
I did not know
and
that.
This was
very good, Gary. I never knew that.
This was an early job that Farley had because I was beginning to think, you know, that it always seemed odd to me that Jim is a California guy. I mean, he's just born and bred a California guy, and it almost seemed weird to me that he was coming to Dearborn, despite the fact that he would always hold forth about his grandfather had worked for Henry Ford, and his first car was a Mustang that he rebuilt and drove from California to Michigan. I mean, and did all this sort of stuff. But it's just like, you know, he's going what? Six more time zones away from California, which seems sort of strange to me.
More than six, nine. That's
right. And, yeah, measuring from here to there. But, you know, I think that it's a good thing for Jim that car sales in Europe are beginning to trend upward. They were up 5% this past month, and so he's going there at a good time. And so if he can sort of build this one Ford momentum that we've seen here over the past several years, I think it'll be really good for the company to be able to say, okay, we've got, you know, North America sorted. Now we're getting Europe sorted.
Well, I think also you've got a new CEO coming in, and you've got these other top guys who there isn't that much of an age difference, right? I mean, I think you want to give them some new challenges and some new experience that can, you know, at least set them up for the future. That's the most benign way of looking at it. Mm-hmm. Another way may have been looking at, well, okay, I'm going to, you know, mess up these guys' personal lives and we'll see, you know. we'll see who stays on board, you know. I mean, I'm not sure what to make of it, but I think... ultimately, you want to, with very ambitious people near the top, you want to keep them challenged, and that's probably a way to do it.
Yeah, I see it a little bit differently, you know, tangentially different, not a whole lot different from you guys, but, you know, Ford of Europe's not making money. You know, they were supposed to be making money by now. They're not making money. In fact, they've already issued new guidance saying, guess what, we're not going to make money next year either. Time for a change. Meanwhile, you look at Ford sales in the U.S., they're down. They're absolutely down.
Yeah.
Even if you take the F-150 out, just take that out, you know, this year and last year, their sales are down. The market is up. I mean, how can you possibly have your sales go down and be losing market share in such a strong market? Time for a change. I'm talking management changes. What I find curious is they have these two guys swapping their jobs. This is going to make or break their careers. I mean, Farley might be able to do a whole lot for marketing and whatnot at Ford, but Ford's real problem in Europe right now is not making money. I'm not sure marketing your way out of the problem is really going to be the way to do it.
Well, but if you think about it, I mean, they've pretty well set themselves in a situation whereby product development is product that's being developed for the world with, you know, the exception of maybe the F-150.
Yeah.
I mean, pretty much, and maybe the Ranger being in
otherwise,
Asia.
It's one Ford.
It's one Ford. So basically, you know, you got what you got. So he's not going to be able to say, oh, we're going to develop some new product that we'll have, you know, uniquely in Europe. So maybe what they'll have to do is to have him in a position whereby he is able to orchestrate some changes in terms of how they go to market, how they are able to retail their vehicles in Europe to begin to maybe make some money. because, you know, they're not going to get a new Fiesta. They're not going to get a new Focus. I mean, there's going to be a new Mondeo, which is our Fusion. I think it's not going to be radically different. That's supposed to be coming out at the before the end of the year. So, you know, what's he going to do besides have an effect on marketing and retail?
I don't know. And to me, Ford's problem in Europe isn't necessarily a marketing problem. I think you guys reported, Drew, that their Ford sales were up 8% in Europe last month.
Yeah.
And to me, this is an operations problem that they have, not a sales and marketing. It's the cost of running the business kind of an issue. And so I find it very curious that they're sending a chief marketing officer over to Europe, where I see it as an operations issue. And very interesting that Steve O'Dell is going to be now become the CMO of the Ford Motor Company.
Well, I mean, I think you also got to look, you know, Al Mulally has left some very big shoes to fill. And so, I mean, some of this may be, again, they are trying to get people more experienced. And, you know, I mean, you look at Mulally's background. He came in with this terrific, he wasn't in cars, but he had this terrific understanding of having a large global engineering and manufacturing operation, and he did a terrific job with it. Now you've got some other good people below him, but they don't have the kind of charisma or the following that Mulally built up in a pretty quick time there.
But let's face it,
look, trying to develop people.
I think the world of Alan Mulally and what he did is spectacular, and he deserves to be in the automotive history books for it. But man, he got out at the right time too, and and that's important too. I mean, you know, he did his thing, but now it's easier to turn around a broken organization than it is then to maintain that success. That's so hard to do.
Well, one might argue the inertial forces that he put in play are still going to carry this company for a while going forward.
No question about it. No question about it.
But, you know, to your point, I think that Mulally was sort of an operations guy and you know, completely non-marketing guy, right? And so maybe what you're suggesting, John, is that Ford of Europe could use an operations guy who could go in there and look very carefully at what the operations are doing, you know, whether it's in England or Romania or wherever.
They haven't been doing that for the past, you know, 5 or 10 years, trying to get that straightened out over there, though? I don't know.
Well, but, you know, and if it was just Ford struggling, we'd say, what's the matter with that company? But it's everybody there is struggling. And in fact, Ford has done some of the heavy lifting already. They've closed a couple of plants in Europe.
Which is no easy thing to do.
Not at all.
Right.
Not at all. You're exactly right. So, you know, but I think it's really puzzling to me. You know, Ford has been saying this was the year. This was the year they were going to break even and maybe even make a little bit of money in Europe. And now they're saying, guess what? That's not even going to happen next year. And that's why I'm saying I find this a curious move. I don't think Ford of Europe's problem is not having the marketing muscle that it needs. Steve O'Dell's background is largely marketing. Mm. So, in fact, that's why he got the CMO job for the Ford Motor Company. So I'm just intrigued at watching this.
But two things. One is don't forget all the turmoil and tumult that's going on in Eastern Europe is having a drag on everyone. I mean, that's having a huge effect. Mm-hmm. And number two, maybe Mark Fields is saying, okay, I need a new set of eyes. I need a new point of view. I need somebody to go in there and look at what's going on, and maybe help.
That's why I said time for a change. There's no question there was time for a change, and you know, in both jobs.
Mm-hmm. But
hey, Drew, we got to get in a plug for your 10 best engines.
Oh, well, thanks.
And just so for anybody knows, the Ward's editorial staff goes and evaluates literally all the engines that are out there in at least the North American market.
And with a price in vehicles with a base price of $60,000 or less. And we've been doing it for 20 years now.
And now it's very prestigious.
Yeah.
I mean, car company, when you guys say this is one of the 10 best, they make a big deal out of it.
Yeah,
it's
been a real pleasure. We're having worked on it the whole 20 years to see how it's evolved and to see.
And I heard that you guys.
You were 8 years old when you started?
Yeah, right. I barely reached
for the first time ever, you're considering a fuel cell car as well.
Right, right. Well, we Hyundai made the case. I mean, it is. It is, you can lease it in California for $500 a month. And so, and
this is what the fuel cells.
The fuel cell Tucson. And it's pretty. I mean, I've been driving fuel cell vehicles for 15 years and have seen amazing things happen with them, from going from these total science projects to now. This is really a vehicle you could get in and really not notice much different, except think, wow, this is a really nice electric vehicle. Only, of course, the big difference is you can drive it 265 miles on one fill up, and you can fill it up in the same time it takes for fill up a regular gas vehicle.
So did you actually go and fill the tank?
No, we did not.
Okay.
So that's
just might be Hyundai propaganda.
But, no, because, you know, I've actually filled up tanks before with some of GM's models and whatnot. They were similar, and it was not, you know, it's a high-pressure thing, and it's not a... not a big deal.
No, I say that facetiously. I know you can fill the tank in about the same time it would take to fill a tank.
So it would be pretty much like CNG, wouldn't it?
Yeah, very much so. Under, you know, higher, this is under 10,000 PSI, so higher pressure.
Yeah, because CNG can be slow.
Yeah.
If you get a low-pressure pump, it can take a while to fill a CNG tank.
So, no, we had a deal set up, and it kind of just fell through for some... I don't know, some weird circumstances. So, no, we did not fill it up ourselves.
The only reason I ask that is I, too, have driven a handful of fuel cell cars over the years. And everyone's talked about, oh, it's so easy to... I have never refueled a fuel cell car, and none of the car companies have ever let me do it.
No. Well, GM had a program, this is back 10 years ago, where we actually...
Chevy Equinoxes.
No, this was before. These were the Astra, I think.
The Opel Zafira?
The Zafiras, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because I spent... God,
you remember the thing we did at the Proving Ground where we set the 24-hour record of driving a fuel cell car?
No, I wasn't on that.
Yeah, we did that. Yeah. One of the things I remember talking about refueling, they had a problem that ice built up on the outside of the connector, and they had a difficult time trying to refuel the thing.
Oh.
And it was, you know, and we're in the desert. I mean, it was like, you know, 100 degrees and like this giant block
chunk
of ice. It was just crazy.
So, well, and if you remember, fuel cells used to be very, you know, you couldn't run them below freezing.
Right. And they were noisy as hell.
Yeah, they found like a fish tank. There were all these fans and bubbles and things. And now it's just perfectly quiet. You don't hear, you lift up the hood while it's running. You don't really hear any noises at all. It's so refined and sophisticated. It's really impressive.
So what do you think? You think it's gonna make it?
Well, we'll see. I because of the engineering, just the incredible engineering that these guys have achieved with this car. You know, I'd like to see it on the list. But you know, other people are raising very legitimate questions about, okay, you know, there's no infrastructure. How legitimate is this, you know, vehicle?
Well, Toyota came out this week saying that they're going to lose, I think the number was $62,000 on every fuel cell car. So they're already over your cap just on what they're going to lose on it.
Here's the issue, though. There's a lot of fake prices going on with the battery electric vehicles, too.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, you know, I think everybody knows Chrysler says they lose $14,000 per car on the electric Fiat 500e, which leases for $300.
And can't you just buy a Fiat 500 for that money?
Yeah.
Just buy the car. You know what I mean?
So, you know, we decided a while ago, look, we're going to, you know, if they can, you know, sort of provide a reasonable argument. I mean, to the consumer, this is obviously a vehicle for what they're paying and going to be insuring it for and everything else. It's going to be a vehicle under, you know, under our price cap. So I think it's legitimate in that point. And the other point is we really want to test these new powertrains because they're becoming very important. Electrics, you know, we still call it the 10 best engines, but we've got, we test hybrids, we test electric vehicles, everything. So because that's... What we're doing is about technology and recognizing what powertrain engineers in particular are doing. So, and this year, it's really, we've got so many different types of engines that it's really fun and really different.
So it's like Swami was saying, materials are all different. You know, it's not just one anymore. And so you guys are finding in terms of powertrain, it's not just one.
Yeah, it's absolutely. It's like... It's like we're going back to the turn of the century when they had steam engines and battery-powered cars and IC engines and all sorts of things. I mean, that's what we're getting. I mean, we've even sort of called this, you know, our diversity training for powertrain this year because we've got so many different engines. But it's really a blast, really. There's so much variety, so much new technology that we've even got a new serial hybrid in the BMW i3. Where that's got a range extender on it, and it's got battery power. It's kind of like the reverse of the Volt, though, where the Volt you can go almost a regular sized fuel tank, and you can drive across country with it. This is more of a true range extender, where the fuel tank probably only takes you about an extra 50 miles or so, 55 miles. But that's obviously pretty crucial. In a car with an electric range.
When you're running out of juice.
Yes, when you're running out of juice. So, I mean, it really brings a new dimension to EVs. So it's really just stunning, the stuff we're testing this year.
Speaking of powertrains and the diversity of powertrains, I was thinking of Oliver Schmidt that we had from VW here a few weeks ago. And so what do you guys think about Motor Trend naming the Golf family of cars as the car of the year? So they're specifically calling out the diesel version, the GTI version, the 1.8-liter normally aspirated, and the e-Golf as being the car of the year. So what do you guys think? A whole family rather than one car.
Well, look, the new Golf is really impressive. It's a terrific car. It's curious that Motor Trend, a U.S.-based publication, is choosing a car that looks to be sales-proof in the American market. Yeah. You know, and I understand, they're not looking at how things sell. They're saying, here's what we think is the coolest or best car that's out there. But nonetheless, I find it a little bit curious. I think there's far more intriguing cars out there than the new Golf, which is a great car. I'm not knocking it at all. But, you know, boy, the BMW i3, I think, is a game changer for this industry. I happen to be in a couple of different Mustangs this week. Man, the more I drive that car, the more I like it. Yeah. I think it's better than when I first drove it. I was on the long lead for that, and I thought, yeah, this is a pretty good car. But now that I'm in, you know, my normal everyday kind of driving, I appreciate it even more. I'm not sure I would have chosen the Golf myself.
What do you think, Drew?
Yeah, well, I think this is, you know, we're seeing platform consolidations now so much that with globalization and more vehicles are being based on a single platform, I see where, you know, if you're really taking a big picture look at the automotive market, it kind of makes sense. We're seeing a lot of a lot of vehicles based off the same platform, and the consumer, he's going to go into, or he or she goes into, a Volkswagen dealership, and you have all these incredible choices now from a diesel or an electric, you know, all the same car, and yet they have their own unique, totally unique personality if you're going from an e-Golf to a regular Golf or whatever. So, you know, I can understand that where you've got one vehicle with so many different personalities that you really can't narrow it down to one. And so here you've got this huge global platform. They don't sell a lot in the U.S., but globally they're huge. So I can kind of understand maybe they're trying to take a little different look at the industry.
So, what do you think of the Golf being Motor Trend Car of the Year?
I think the most interesting part, and you had a good explanation as to why this is the case, I think. But I mean, it surprised me that they were calling out the whole group of cars rather than saying it's the GTI.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, that struck me as odd. But I mean, I think the more curious part is that, you know, you mentioned that it's a sales-proof car, and if you look at their numbers of Volkswagen's numbers, I mean, they're down 12% for the year. And as you said earlier, you know, this is an up market, and they're down 12%. Why is Volkswagen sales-proof, as you put it, in the United States?
Boy, if I could give you the answer to that.
Well,
the answer to Volkswagen for millions of dollars.
No, I'll give you one answer, one-word answer, trucks. They don't have any really good... They've got one compact CUV. I mean, they need about three, you know, if you look, what's selling now? It's all selling. We're back to selling
SUVs, CUVs,
and pickups.
Well, I mean, they've got the Tiguan. The Tiguan's down 17% for the year.
Yeah, and that's not
Touareg.
New.
Touareg is down 15.6% for the year.
So that there's your answer. They got a big problem. I think it's got to do with, I think it starts at the dealership level. I think a lot of their dealers in the United States do not have good geographical positions, you know, the neighborhoods that they're in, literally. I think that, you know, we talked about sales and marketing before. They have not cracked that code in the American market. They've done ad campaigns.
Yeah, they've won big the Darth Vader little kid thing.
They do things that people go, oh, isn't that a cute car? But does nothing to motivate them to go say, you know, I'm going to go down to my local Volkswagen dealership. People don't even know where their local Volkswagen dealership is in the United States.
Well, and Volkswagen has never had a commitment to the U.S. market. I mean, you see them, their dealers complain forever that they'll get a glut of new product for a while, and then they'll have too many vehicles almost to sell in terms of models, and then they get nothing for a couple of years. And they're not treated like a key market, and I think this has forever been the problem. Volkswagen doesn't, and they have this sort of one-size-fits-all philosophy that works really well all around the world.
Yeah, but they built that big factory in Chattanooga to build the special Passat just for us.
Yes.
That we're the only ones who get that car. When it came out, everybody couldn't say enough about it.
Yeah, it was great.
How good it is,
but
right.
It looked like an old Camry to me, but that's another story. I mean, that's not selling, okay?
Right.
So, I mean, here's a car for us.
Right.
Yeah.
Look, they've gone through management changes. They got a new guy in there right now. This Chattanooga plant, from a profit standpoint, is a disaster. From a big brouhaha of what union is going to come in and represent the workers is another disaster. I mean,
But didn't they announce this week they're setting up a room for the UAW or something so they can come in and chat?
Yeah.
Well, then they've got another one, a competing group, an anti-union group they now have
you
to
have
make,
a room for them and they go in and chat too?
I believe, yeah.
I don't know. I don't see the light at the end of the tunnel for Volkswagen of America. I just don't see it.
I think they figured out China. They figured out every global market in the world. They just can't figure out the U.S.
So maybe we're truly inscrutable.
Yeah.
Right. Hey, I've had a fun week learning all about hacking into cars. And, you know, I've seen the YouTube videos of there's a couple of yahoos out there who take a crowbar and they break the instrument panel off a Prius. And then they go through the OBD2 sensor and they splice wires in. And there's these guys giggling in the back seat, tapping into a laptop, controlling things in the car. And I went,
why don't you just steal the car? You know,
I mean, you want to do something to somebody? Take a hacksaw to the brake lines.
Yeah.
That's the way you go and get back at someone. But this Israeli company came in called TowerSec, and they claim they've got a way of using software to prevent anybody from being able to hack a car. But so I've spent part of this week reading research papers all about car hacking, and man, has it opened my eyes. You can definitely hack into a car wirelessly. In fact, we got an article on our website right now, 6 ways to wirelessly hack your way into a car. And these are all short range, you know, 5 meters to 300 meters. You don't have to be touching the car. You can be that far away. And the next article, I got to read more of the research paper on this, is you can hack into a car from thousands of miles away. You can hack into cars and from different countries.
Well, yeah, when we were talking earlier, I thought it was fascinating where you could, being capable to many new cars, being able to download songs, you could trick somebody into downloading an infected song, which then can just take over your car.
Yeah, I had no idea about this. So you corrupt a song file with malicious software in it, and then you blast out emails, texts, tweets, saying, hey, here's a cool song, check this out. So if you play it in your car player, this cryptic message comes up on, you know, the screen of your audio player. And you go, what the hell is this? And you try to push a button to get it to clear. If you don't hit the exact right button, and it can be whatever on the system. It reflashes the whole thing and loads it with corrupted software, and they're in. And that's what I learned. Once you're on the CAN bus, the controller area network, you're in the car. You can do whatever you want to it.
It's a little difficult. It's not that easy. I did a story a year or two ago for Car and Driver on this subject, and it's a little bit more. And I read all those papers and did the whole thing, and it's a little more. And so physical media is actually easier for that to happen. So, for example, if somebody gives you a CD and says you really need to listen to this CD, and you put that in your car, that is an easier way of doing it. Just the same way it happens with your PC, or if you get a USB stick and they say, here, you know, stick this in your car and listen to this. That is a means. And so I talked to a bunch of suppliers about this, and they made the point they're completely cognizant of the fact that they need to have safety and security that are built into keeping things from like that from happening. Now, yeah, certainly it's sort of I think analogous to if you're in a hotel and you're using Wi-Fi, you know, you're probably not advised to put in your American Express account number as you're using this public thing. And it's the same thing in cars. I mean, they're just saying, okay, if you're a node on the internet, which is essentially what cars are turning into, then you've got to think about your car in terms of safe computing the same way you do it, you know, with your phone or your tablet or your PC. But, you know, absolutely, this is a whole hornet's nest that has to be managed. I mean, that there's just no way around it because, you know, we all expect more and more technology into vehicles, and that just means more compute power, and more compute power means a greater opportunity for things to go pear-shaped. And if people do want to hack into it, you know, it's going to make, Target's cash register problem look like a walk in the park.
Right. No, what these guys were telling me, these cybersecurity guys, was that updating your cybersecurity software is going to become routine maintenance, like getting an oil change or a tune-up. You're going to have your update because you put on these anti-cyber hacking safety systems, somebody's going to figure out how to get around it. So you're going to have to be constantly updating it.
So do they want to be like Comcast now, that you get free antivirus software? And you know, is that... Do they want to be like this? They're the supplier of the antivirus software, so you get it with your car, and as you turn on, it says, hey, your car is protected by...
Well, yeah. What they told me is once you're on the CAN bus, you know, which is the central nervous system of the electronics of a car, you can get anywhere in a car, and you can start to control anything that you want. As Gary pointed out, it's not easy. You got to reverse engineer software. You got to be able to send packets of information that are recognized as legitimate, even though they're not. So it takes effort. But no, what these guys in particular want to do is license their software to an OEM, just like Microsoft would license your software. But here's the big difference, and this was what was so intriguing, is there's other companies out there selling cybersecurity, one in particular that's got hardware, $150 for the box that they want to put in a car. Well, that's like a non-starter for car companies. What this TowerSec company was saying is they can license it for under $10 a car.
Yeah.
Maybe $5 a car.
So, but what's in it for the hacker? I don't understand. I mean...
Well, they told me there's three types of hackers. One are the people who do it just for the pure joy of hacking. And they said these are the guys who love to hack into a bank and then send an email to the bank president saying, ha, 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 I got into your system. But they're not malicious about it. The second category are criminal. They're just in it because they're going to get money. Maybe they're going to steal your car. Maybe they're going to steal information of yours on a car. As the guy told me, he says, if you're using your infotainment system to order a pizza, guess what? Your car now has your credit card information. So that's attractive to thieves. And then the third category is terrorists, you know, people who want to create mass mayhem. So those are what they're looking at as the three layers of protection that they've got to go up against.
So would it be possible for them, they mentioned that they could make the airbag go off spontaneously something like that?
Oh, wow. And today, you know, with electric steering in more and more cars, and, you know, we talked about lane keeping and all that, where the steering wheel nudges things back in. So, yeah, you can control everything. You can unlock the doors. You can blow off the airbag. You can control the engine, the brakes, the steering, you name it. And so what you could even do is introduce, you know, malicious software that's triggered by what they call an environmental event. So it could be a specific time, a specific day, or tying into the GPS. It could be once you get to a specific location. It could say, hey, drive off the cliff. So it opened my eyes. I had no idea how vulnerable cars can be. Again, emphasizing, this isn't easy. This isn't for just anybody to jump into, but it's totally doable.
Well, it sounds like a plot for a good movie or book.
This is for Bond villains. This is, you know, this is what it's all about. And so Daniel Craig has to worry about it, and the rest of us probably not so much, you know?
Hey, we should probably wrap it up here, but great discussion. Good stuff.
And you're going to be in Los Angeles next week doing the show?
I am. And in fact, for everybody who wants to tune in, we're going to be at the Honda Performance Division. This is where Honda does all of its performance stuff, from IndyCar engines to off-road racing, a bunch of motorcycle stuff. It could be pretty cool. They're letting us into the inner sanctum here. I'm sure they're not going to show us anything too top secret, but it should be a fun show. So, guys, real good having you.
Yeah.
Real good. I want to thank all of you for having tuned in.
AutoLine After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone. Your journey, our passion.
Visit our website, autoline.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday nights at 6 p.m. Eastern. Get your daily news fix with AutoLine Daily and in-depth analysis and interviews with AutoLine This Week. There's all that and much more at AutoLine.tv.